You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
I sang Dixie as she died.
Now, what's this song about, Mike?
People just walked on by.
Hello?
You gotta listen to it. You there?
Yeah, but I'm not, I mean, explain what it's about.
Well, I like it. I like it right about, keep going, right about, coming up right here, this is the best part.
All right, we'll listen.
Right here.
Said way down the yonder in the land of God, old times ain't near as rotten as they are on this damned old
California.
Oh, so he's California bashing, so that's what you like?
Yeah.
I saw him interviewed about the song. He said he was, he said it was downtown in Los Angeles and he saw something that made him want to be home.
Yeah. And yeah, every time I was in California, you go to LA, it made me want to go home.
Yeah,
right?
Through that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not the
kind. Hey.
Yes.
I want to tell you something.
Okay.
There are very few times in my life that I'm actually kind of surprised. Like taken back. Like, wow, I didn't expect this. Because, remember, I tell you, my expectations of people is set that rheostat set to zero.
Low.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah, if it could go lower, it would. Because I don't expect anything from anybody.
Because all you do is set yourself up for disappointment.
For disappointment, right. Yeah. So I don't do that anymore.
Right.
What I saw now recently
is
I read into the book, The Blonde Knight of Germany.
Yeah.
And, you know, we talk a lot about leadership on this and everything kind of ties to it, and, you know, and kind of describing a good leader and all this stuff. And let me tell you, I was reading a couple chapters and then I'd stop and then I'd go and research some more online with what kind of person he was, you know, and I'm starting to think of, and you know, I like stories of personal accomplishment, like individual accomplishment, like Shackleton's story about about the expedition to the South Pole. You know, people that have been to the brink and come back. And here is a guy he was 23 years old when he was put in a gulag in 1945. Okay? In 1942, he entered the Luftwaffe, and in 1945, in those 3 years, he had racked up 352 aerial kills. 1,800 times he had taken off in his airplane. 1,800 times he'd taken off his airplane. And in those 1,800 times, 800 of them he actually fought. He was in aerial combat. So a sortie, you fly in your plane, you get out. Sometimes you don't run in, you don't do something, you land. That counts as a sortie. They would run two or three sorties a day. As soon as they land, they refuel, rearm, get back up in the air.
How many air medals is that?
I don't think they're past air medals.
Do we have to give him another medal so he could get all the numerals on his air medal?
He wins the Knight's Cross.
Yes.
Which is the highest honor, right? That's the one that you see the movies they wear around their neck.
Yes.
And then he wins the wreaths, which is the second, the next order. It's like the next highest order. Then he wins the swords, and then he wins the coveted diamonds, the cluster of diamonds. So that's the highest. There is nothing higher than that medal. So he has the Knight's Cross, which is like the Medal of Honor. And then he has not only the Medal of Honor, but he has the third, second, and first order of it. if there was such a thing for the Medal of Honor.
Right. And so, and just remember this. They didn't convene a board and look at what he did again and upgrade it, okay? These were for subsequent events.
Right.
Yes.
So for, yeah, 301st aerial kill, he finally wins his diamonds. 301 kills. 301 airplanes shot down the sky. 301. I don't think we even have 301 airplanes in the Air Force, Navy, and the Marine Corps combined.
What? You might be right about that. What about, and how old did you say he was when he went to the Gulag? So he's a young guy when he does all this stuff.
23.
He's 23 in 1945, so he's doing this.
Yeah.
Whoa.
23, dude. 23.
But you would, and so you would think that, I mean, he's one of those Motorhead guys, right? Wanted to fly, he's a Motorhead. But you're talking about him as a leader.
So as a leader, he gets to prison, and the Russians try and break him. They can't kill him.
Right.
You know, and you read about this atrocities, and that it makes me want to like read more about what the Russians. I mean, I.
Well, wait a minute. Why can't the Russians kill him? It's not like it's a big deal.
Because this is after post-war. They're already taking a lot of scrutiny of and a lot of heat from the international world of they're putting all the what the Russians did was they won the war, okay, they're part of the winning team, but they got their ass kicked by Germany. I mean, yeah, the Russians pushed back, you know, and pushed them all the way out, but really when you look at sheer numbers, the Germans kicked the shit out of those guys. And if it hadn't been for the Brits and the Americans and the rest of the allies, there would be no Russia today. You know, and you kind of look at it and go, God, you know, what were we doing? We should have came in, like, let them finish that off. Not a bad thing. So they get the living crap kicked out of them. So it's revenge after the war. So they take everybody and they put them in gulags. They take families. You know, you're the family, you're the daughter, the 12-year-old daughter of name somebody that they don't like, some general, and you're going to the gulag. You know, so they gulagged everybody and then made them sign these, you know, I'm so sorry, gosh, Russia is such a great place, and I can't wait to get back to Eastern Russia to start my blurry, colorless life as an East German citizen. So the ones that sign it get out of the gulags. Hartman doesn't. He stands firm, and he stands to the true nature that he was doing his job. He never committed a war crime. He did his job. He was a fighter pilot, and he was a very good fighter pilot. And there were times of chivalry in the air. You know, he guys ran out of bullets in a fight. He let them go. Wasn't a fair kill. Come back and see me. I'll be in the same airspace tomorrow. Come check me out. He had a black tulip on his nose and a red heart on the side of his fuselage. So people knew who this guy was. They, you know, can you imagine flying and you're like, we're in formation, I'm looking at him, like, hey, Mac, I've looked down there. And you're like, let's get out of here. Here's the black tulip. You know? Like, shit, yeah. I mean, yeah. I got 2 kills under my belt. Hey, I'm going to go tangle with this guy. What? You're just going to end up as another notch on his belt. I mean, he very rarely made errors. So his leadership, when he gets to the gulag, he inspires people because his stance towards it and his, you know, he believed what he did was right and he stood up for it. And so he's talking about all these Russian or German generals, the ones that were in the gulags as well. They were traitors. They did everything to save their own ass. And it was a complete opposite. It was the privates and the sergeants in the German army that came and became these leaders in these gulags to inspire these people to, you know, resist. And he became Booby Hartman. That's what they call him, boy or lad, Booby boy. He became one of them. And so he lasts throughout the gulag. The Russians tried to, he went on hunger strikes. So they finally, and you know, then they do the, they put him from gulag to gulag to gulag. Well, all that does is spread the story of this guy. So the resistance becomes stronger. And finally, 10 years after his his initial internment into the Gulag, the Chancellor of Germany gets him freed into West Germany. He arrives home as a hero, you know, as a true hero, POW, and then struggles with it, you know, just like everybody else. And then he struggles. He wanted to be a physician, like his father. He wanted to be a doctor. But he's 33 now, you know, 10 years in the Gulag. They don't count for credits. And then they gets into the West German Air Force, and the rest becomes history. Comes back to the United States, does all this stuff, stands up the first West German jet fighter wing, and really has a great time. And so it's amazing. What's amazing is you read these stories about, I mean, so now think about this, Mac. Let's say you're a colonel, a general, right? You were a fighter pilot in World War II, and you got 6 kills. You were good. You're an ace.
Right.
You're a big deal, man. You walk into the ready room, and all the other pilots are looking at you going, shit, there's General Mac. He's an ace. He's got 6 kills. Right? Booby Hartman walks into the ready room, and people go, oh, my God. And then words don't even come out. You know? Here's a guy who had over 800 aerial engagements fighting and 352 confirmed kills. What do you call that guy? What is 352 divided by 5? You know?
What do you call him?
Trenchcoat ace? What?
Whatever he wants to be called.
Yeah.
That's what you call him. Like, what do you want me to call you? Sir? You're the man.
Well, yeah, his nickname was Booby. Boy.
Call me Booby. If that's what he wanted. Yeah. If that's what he wanted. Interesting, though, that at such a young age, the leadership piece of it. Because, you know, pilots are, I mean, they're not, you know, they're pilots, right?
Here's a great story.
They don't grow up.
Pilots are pilots.
Yeah, they don't grow up in a world of leadership the way ground units grow up in that.
So, four pilots, Booby Hartman, one of them, Barkhorn, and I've read about Barkhorn. Barkhorn was one of the German leading aces. Is I think like 200 or 100 and something kills, over 200 kills.
Wow.
Adolf Galland, you know, another guy. He lived throughout the war. But Barkhorn, Hartman, Kerpensky, who's another 100 guy, and I forget the fourth guy. Four aces are beckoned to the Eagle's Nest to be awarded. Hartman's getting his swords for his knight. Barkhorn is getting his no. The three guys are getting their wreaths, so the next step after the Knight's Cross, Barkhorn's getting his swords.
Ooh.
Second step.
And
yeah,
the Eagle's Nest is Hitler's
retreat
in Bavaria, on the Bavarian border. And if you've ever seen pictures of it, and it's where the 82nd Airborne, Dick Winters and all that. You see it in Band of Brothers.
Today. It doesn't exist.
Well, there's still trails, and you can go there.
Yeah, but they
destroyed most of it.
Austria, and then the one outside of Salzburg, that's the Wolf's Lair. That still exists. They didn't blow that one up, but they blew the Eagle's Nest.
Yeah, they blew it up. Yeah, if you look at it, you can go online and you can see. Like the terrain as it is today, there's still roads and infrastructure that they'll superimpose pictures on it. And so this is where
beautiful.
This was. Yeah. Oh my God. Breathtaking. And in Band of Brothers, the 82nd Airborne and those guys, they go there, they get sent there and they wind up getting drunk and living there. Anyway, going with your story.
So, the four pilots are on a train ride, and they don't know each other. They meet for the first time on the train, and they've heard of each other's exploits, so they become instant friends, and they start telling stories. And then the conductor, they meet with the conductor, so they bust open bottles of cognac, because the conductor's like, holy crap, these guys are, you know, these are rock stars in Germany, and they're on my train. So the pilots get hammered, right?
Of course.
Of course. Uniforms all jacked up. They're rah, rah, rah. Bottles walking off the train. Rah, rah, rah. And there's the aide-de-camp, Hitler's aide-de-camp for the Luftwaffe sitting there, a major, who's not going to put these guys in their place. I mean, these guys are...
Because he doesn't want to Yeah, he doesn't want to either get headbutted or shot or both. Right?
So he's like, holy shit. And he tells them, you idiots, you're going to meet with... You're meeting with the Fuhrer in 2 hours. And so they're like, oh, shit. We're in trouble. So... It's like a 30, 40 minute ride, and it's in the middle of winter. So this Luftwaffe aide-de-camp orders the driver of this Mercedes to take the top down. We're driving with the top down. So these four pilots from the back of this Mercedes freezing their ass off, getting this cold weather, getting the shock, you know, like,
That'll thin the alcohol in your blood system.
Yeah, so they get there. They're still drunk.
Right.
So they start pumping them with, you know, whatever is water, drinking
coffee.
Yeah. And they're making them stay outside to get cold, stay cold, because that keeps you kind of peppy. And as Hitler's getting ready to award them, they call them into the building. So they straighten them all up. Booby Hartman walks in to Hitler's den, and there's a hat on the hat rack. And so what does he do?
He
goes over and says, there is my hat. And he picks it up, puts it on, and Booby Hartman's a little guy. He's got like a 6 3/4 head. And I guess Adolf has a 7 3/4 head. So he puts his hat on, and they immediately, all of the pilots start laughing their ass off because his hat goes all the way down and all his ears are sticking out.
Soup cooler.
Yeah. And his ears are sticking out. And the aide-de-camp looks over, and he freaks out because Hitler's about ready to walk in the room. Runs over there, grabs the hat from Booby, snatches it off his head, and says, that's the Fuhrer's hat. You know, and they're like,
whatever, dude.
As he walks in the room, he puts it on the hat rack, and they stand at attention, he gets the thing, and they shake hands, and they're all buddies, and Hitler leaves, and they get drunk again. So nothing is, nothing changes. You know, when you're that kind of guy, when you're like, you didn't violate anything, you're not hurting anything, you're just releasing.
And you're drunk.
Yeah, and you just release. It's a release, right?
Right.
No one gets hurt. It's fun. It's innocent play.
Yeah, and but Hitler had a way of like sucking the air out of the room. You know, he had that. You know him.
He's a killjoy, man.
The bad mustache and the bad haircut. I mean, that always puts people on edge. When somebody rolls in with the bad haircut, bad mustache, and everybody's like deferring to them. You know, and what's the first question? It's like, dude, you know that mustache sucks, and the haircut with it, it's horrible, man. Do you have a stylist around that could help your fucked up ass out?
Yeah. Well, he's got the comb over type thing. You can always imagine him, like, sweeping his head back. But I always like the line that's out there.
Have you ever watched him? Have you ever watched him give a speech? It's like, if you're sitting there.
You know, hey, I've read a lot about. A lot of people will tell you some of the greatest speech makers in the world today were psychopaths.
No, name a few.
Like Hitler, Stalin, Mao Zedong. Because they could get people to do things that people normally wouldn't want to do. They motivate you. He would capture the room. He comes in with this relaxing voice and then crescendos and then brings it back down at the end of the speech. And you walk out of there. And people, and I've read a lot about Hitler's speeches after the war, and people would tell, and even experts would say, hey, I didn't like the guy, but holy crap, he could capture the, the room.
Really? Because whenever, the clips, and maybe they're edited, so we just see him at his worst, like, it looks like he's spitting and gesticulating, and it's like, who wouldn't look at that and go, dude, that dude, you got issues.
Yeah, man. But it's content, Mac. Yeah, it's the content. Yeah.
Well, no, and let me just tell you, I don't think, you talk about guys who were rock stars. He yanked Germany, right? National Socialism yanked Germany out of post-World War I, anarchy, depression, rampant unemployment, and gave them their identity back. Yeah. And so he was that guy that did it.
Yeah.
Very,
if you
very
take away the freaking heinous war crime, all that other crap he did. I mean,
you could take just away all the rest
of
it.
All that. I mean,
You can, you know, he's legit.
He invented the freeway.
You know, and promoted Volkswagen. You got to clean that act up a little bit. But the if you look at his speeches, though, it's always like, dude, geez, that's interesting.
But it's
let me read you some.
You understand the content of it. Yeah. They're pretty good speeches.
Yeah, no, I mean, when you have to look at it in the context of its time.
Yeah.
Let's see. Here are some numbers.
I would recommend for those that are serious readers. Those that are serious readers, you know, that like content, not the bullshit that's out there today in a lot of books. You know, I don't read fictional books.
Like what?
Ever. Well, the only I should say.
Like Marine?
The only ones that I've ever enjoyed were...
Burke Davis about Chesty Puller? Like, the only thing missing from that is colored crayons. Come on.
No, fiction. Like, the only ones that I... Who wrote, Red October? What was his name?
Tom Clancy.
Tom Clancy's the only fictional writer that I like. Because it's borderline, it sounds true.
Right.
You know?
No, I think that genre is called faction, in that it's based on fact, and then he messes with the characters and the incidents but otherwise, all you know, when he's talking about the Hunt for the Red October and he's talking about S3 and he's talking about anti-submarine warfare, all that stuff is right out of what we did. In fact, I was talking. My mom used to love his books, and I said, you know, Mom, they're pretty technical. Do you enjoy that? She says, well, some of that I don't understand, but I kind of understand it. I said, okay. Because I was surprised that when I read it, it is pretty sophisticated relative to that. Let me read you some numbers, Mike. These are German prisoner of war numbers. The West German government set up a commission headed by Erich Manschke to investigate the fate of German POWs in the war. Its report of 1974, they found the following. 3,060,000 German military prisoners were taken prisoner by the USSR. 3 million, okay?
Yeah.
Hello.
60,000 returned.
Yeah. 1,940,250 died in captivity. All right? That's a third of them died in captivity. According to German historian Rüdiger Overmach, 3 million POWs were taken by Russia. He put the maximum number of POW deaths in Soviet hands at 1 million, based on research. Most of those were repatriated in, what year was it? 1945, all but 85,000 prisoners of war had been released and repatriated. Most of those still held had been convicted of war crimes, and many sentenced to longer terms in forced labor camps, usually 25 years. It was not until 1956 that the last of the war convicts were repatriated to Germany following the intervention of West German Chancellor Konrad Adenauer in Moscow. That's a lot of prisoners of war. 3 million, a third of them die in captivity. And it's not like the Russians, you know, they didn't give too much of a shit about the Germans. And again, we, you know, when we talk about war, you know, and you read American history, and then you read about the war that the Germans and the Russians fought, literally your jaw drops to the floor. The size of the battles, the size of the logistics, the conditions they fought in are blow your mind.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, blow your mind. And
so you think about you're talking about repatriate is there was 400,000 German prisoners still in 1947 in Britain. Almost 2 years after the war, they still hadn't been released. Isn't that crazy?
Yes.
They were held as in March 1947, 170,000 were still working in agriculture, helping farmers bring in the harvest. International law stipulated that POWs re-released after the peace treaty was signed, but with Germany occupied, a peace treaty was a remote possibility.
Right. And the Germans did not want to go back to anything that Russia was anywhere close to. They're living in who was it? General Lynch came on. Jarvis Lynch came on to talk about when he was a kid growing up in southern New Jersey, there was German POWs that worked the harvest.
Carolinas.
He said we'd go up and talk to them, and you know they had learned some English, and we. You know, he said it was kind of, you know, exotic in terms of being a young guy, and you'd see these guys out in the field. And they did not want to go back to Germany until, you know, it was settled where they would go and that they wouldn't be given to the Russians, because there was no doubt in their minds anyway what would happen to them if they were. So interesting. Yeah, you know, that side of the war is, you know, it blows your mind. You know, even when you talk about, you know, think about that. A million German soldiers died in captivity. In captivity. Okay? A million. Okay? And so, you know, if you look at Russian estimates are 20 million Russians die. Both military, 8.7 military deaths, which is, again, statistics in Russia, blah, 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 blah. So Russian President Dmitry Medvedev in 2009 said that data about our losses hasn't been revealed yet. We must determine the historical truth. He said that more than 2.4 million people are still officially listed as missing. Of the 9.5 million buried in mass graves and 6 million of those are unidentified, some Russian politicians and journalists put the total number of losses in the war, both civilian and military, at over 40 million people.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing. And then if you look at, so somewhere, and again, people say 20 million is too much, but again, it's Russia, so who the hell knows? How about German total losses, civilian and military, in World War II?
That's never known. I mean, it's like, there's like, and the problem, you know, so the whole hatred that I have is, you know, you see this and you're like, well, the Germans are responsible for, no, the Germans, the average German soldier was not responsible for the death of the Jews.
Right.
That was a group, a sect, the SS, even the SS gets a bad name because you had the Waffen SS, which was the military wing.
Right.
They were just a loyal, freaking crazy, fanatical military group. And then you had the SS under Himmler that carried out the, you know, the final solution. So yeah, it kind of goes back and forth.
You can't, and it's very frustrating. It's very frustrating to have a discussion with somebody who doesn't read the footnotes of history, you know, and calls German soldiers Nazis.
Yeah, look, it's like calling Rommel a Nazi. Right. You know that son of that Rommel died, you know, as a German officer trying to dispose of the Nazi, you know, party.
Right. So it's frustrating people who don't. And I would say the same thing for the American Civil War when you're, you know, Lincoln, the Great Emancipator. Well,
yeah, right, bull ass right there.
Not so great, you know. Who said this? If I can save the Union and not free a slave, I will do that. In order to save the Union, I have to free all the slaves, I will do that. But I will save the Union. Does that sound like the Great Emancipator to you?
Yeah, that's President Lincoln.
That was Lincoln. That's a quote. And so when you peel the footnotes of history, it doesn't really line up with some of the things.
Yeah, he's the Great Emancipator.
Yeah.
No, he did what he had to do to
save the Union. That was his goal.
Save the Union.
Yeah. And if you don't get that, then, I think you and I talked about this, but even like, how could we allow, you know, the South to put up these monuments to the war dead, their racist leaders that caused the American Civil War? Well, initially they were not allowed to. But in order to bind the wounds and heal the nation, from to date, the bloodiest war in American history, there was concessions made.
Right.
So that we would bind our wounds and we would come together as a country. Now, that doesn't get told as part of the story of these monuments.
No.
Because that would
require hatred states. Right. It's a hatred statement putting those statues up.
Right.
That's what, because the truth doesn't matter, people.
Exactly.
Hello, wake up, knock you on the side of the head. I was talking about this last night with, you know, George. He sent the email.
Yes.
You know, working
yes.
for the cops program.
Yep.
So we were at the, we were at a meeting last night. We were talking about that. We were talking about the truth doesn't matter. And he said, yeah, listen to that. And then, you know, we were talking about it. But, you know, it's funny when I see the faces of some of the people at the table last night. They're looking at me and we're talking about that and how things, and you see them look at you like, you know, when you're being told for the first time that Santa Claus doesn't exist. What? 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 That there's no Easter Bunny. There's no Tooth Fairy. What?
What?
What? Yes. Are you serious? Did you really think that there was a little fairy that floated in on dusty little sparkly wings through the window and deposited a freaking quarter for your tooth?
Yes. My mom told me.
Yeah.
Is my mom lying?
I mean, what is she doing with teeth, the gross woman? You know? God, get out of my house. You know, my teeth are only worth a quarter? What? So, I mean, or there's a giant bunny that gives me candy and poops chocolate eggs?
Yes.
What?
How awesome is that?
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Why would I want to eat?
What do you mean he doesn't exist?
Yeah, why would I want to eat?
First of all, they don't poop it. They give birth to it.
Give birth? They poop out chocolate eggs.
Whoa, nobody's pooping out anything, okay? They give birth to the egg. Thank you.
That we eat.
Yes.
That's even grosser. That's
scramble.
Poop.
Yeah, ovaries. They're called. Yeah. I remember Saturday Night Live did this skit, and it was the Coneheads, and Beldar comes out and he says, he's good at cook breakfast. The custom here on Earth is jumbled chicken embryos. Would you like them? And you're like, whoa, chicken embryos? And then you're like, well, I guess that's what those are. I guess that's what those are.
Yeah, well, when you say it like that, no one wants to eat them. You want scrambled chicken embryos this morning for breakfast? They look at you like, no, Dad. You guys just want eggs? Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, hide the truth.
Yes.
Yes. You know, so we were talking about this whole article, and then when I was researching this stuff, we had a bunch of German prisoners here in Huntsville, Texas in World War II, and they worked on the cotton fields.
Right.
Picking cotton, and, you know, because a lot of people were still at war. And a lot of them actually came back, or they stayed. And they started families here and, you know, towns and organizations or groups of today.
Adopt, took them in and adopted them and whatnot.
Yeah, but they're interviewing one guy. And I guess when they had him in the camps here, they showed him a video of what the prisoner of war camps looked, or the concentration camps. When they finally had to end the war, they showed these prisoners the footage from these concentration camps.
Right.
And one prisoner was asked, how do you feel? The German soldier said, it makes me feel uneasy. However, I don't understand why you're making such a big deal out of it. You treat the black people here in this country the same way we did the Jews.
Oh, hey, no need to play that card. Whoa, we're not talking about us. We're talking about
don't
you.
Bring up the truth, son of a bitch.
Scumbag, what the hell?
You know, and it was like, whoa.
I say, boy, that's the last thing we need on our television. Edit out that last question, and then we're good. Roll that shit. It's a good story.
Clip that. Don't ever bring it. So, I mean, it was just like, you know, but yeah, they had a point. You know, like, wait a second. You're criticizing. I mean, yeah, we didn't, but you treat the black people worse than the Jews.
Not really. The Jews were, just for the record, historically, the National Socialists treated the Jews much worse than blacks ever got treated in the United States.
Yeah. But in the beginning, it was.
But no, but I mean, when you enslave a population, that's up there, right? And,
yeah.
And so the United States record in terms of civil rights and being a humane, just nation, not so good. Not so good. Right. And even after the Civil War, it took another 100 years before, you know, we gave, you know, before the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
Yeah, absolutely.
So anyway, the I'm looking
great
at
emancipator did his job.
The, yeah, I'm looking at I was looking for some kind of number in terms of civilian military and civilian casualties during World War II, and in Germany, and the number that I saw was 10 million people. So, I mean, so when you think about it, and again, think about numbers in that range, 10 million in Germany, and let's just say it's somewhere between 15 and 30 million in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the kind of war that they waged against each other. I happen to see a picture of it looks like some kind of flat car that's loaded with bodies in Dresden, Germany, after we firebombed the city. And holy shit.
Tried as a war criminal.
Yeah, he would have. You know, and again, that's the American. We did it to Tokyo when we firebombed it, and it had
twice.
Yeah, it had more casualties than either one of the atomic bombs.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is. So once you kind of clear your lenses and you begin to take a look at the war as it was fought. You know, Russia and Germany, holy shit, right? You read those stories,
mm-hmm.
And those guys, I mean, they had lost all hope. And there's a book that I have, and it written by a Catholic German general. He attacked down the same road in World War II that he attacked down in World War I. Through the same forest in the Ardennes, he went down the same damn road, and he talks about receiving the Knight's Cross from Hitler, and he said he had yellow skin. He was 6 inches shorter than I was, and I want to say that he received it after the attempt on his life. You know, his hands were shaking. He said he did not appear the man that I'd seen in the newsreels, but he had this. He was conflicted, but he was German, and when his nation was going to go to war, he was an army officer. You know, he fought for Germany. But the title of the book is Neither Fear Nor Hope, and an interesting title to a book, and a very interesting perspective. Very interesting perspective.
Well, see, our youth of today, they don't understand that stuff. I mean, so when you hear, you know, you hear it all the time, they're like, oh, it's atrocious what we did. We dropped 2 nuclear bombs and all the death that was caused, you know, in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But you're okay with the firebombing of Tokyo that killed probably 4 times as many people? What? That happened? Firebombing in Dresden that
civilians.
Was not even a military target. It was just to kill civilians?
Civilians. Waging war on the population, which is an American thing.
In that room with those general officers, they said, there is no military target, not even a military soldier, maybe one on leave, but all we're going to do is kill civilians. Is everybody okay with that? Yes. I mean, okay, so everybody's good with killing women and children and old people. Yes. Let's do it. That was the discussion that took place in that room. Not, oh shit, we made a mistake. We had some bad intel. And, you know, but again, no one has a problem with that. You know? And like I said, if you're going to bring the truth out, then all of the truth got to come out.
It gets uncomfortable. That is the American concept of total war, that the civilian population is a legitimate target when another nation wages war against you.
Yeah. The atrocities at Malmedy, right, where the Germans killed the American POWs.
Right.
But what about the story about the American soldiers killing the German POWs in the Ardennes Forest? Whoa, whoa. don't make a movie about that. Because it's isolation of the truth. Get it all out there. I'm not saying we're any better or any worse,
no,
but we're all guilty.
Let me say, it's an eye-opener when you do.
Yeah, we're just as guilty. Because when you're guilty, it's not a matter of, well, you're more guilty. You're 99% guilty. You're 1% guilty. You're freaking guilty. We committed war crimes. Yes. But don't ignore the fact. Don't point out that we came in as the saint United States. We are this great place that came in and did nothing good. And no one, we were just the patrons of happiness and,
yeah,
and everything else.
Yeah,
did some pretty atrocious things.
Yeah. No. Let me say, no doubt. But let me say, and then you have to deal with war. So, you know, what we're doing, we're trying to make it so difficult that they would surrender. And
you get to write history.
Right. And using all means to include nuclear weapons at our disposal. Nuclear weapons not dropped on military targets, but dropped on cities. And so waging war against the nation in toto. And so you think about that. And so it's I'll tell you what, very interesting ethical discussions about that. Here's an email. Russia, shoot, Mac, don't we always talk about Hitler and the Holocaust, and rightly so, but never mention how brutal Stalin was to everyone. Just too bad how our educational system and historians passed it by, gave Stalin a break, per se. I don't know that people give Stalin a break.
Stalin killed more people than Hitler.
You see some kind of reconciliation of that, and it's like Stalin is like, he's incredible. But
the founder of that country, you know, the father.
Jesus, he's just a horrible, horrible human being. But again, as Mike was saying, it is such an eye-opener. To begin to read the history of the Eastern Front, and those guys, when you got assigned to the Eastern Front, like now you could understand the title of the book, Neither Fear Nor Hope. I'm not afraid and I'm not hopeful. What am I? I'm in the same spot as Lieutenant Spears. Right? I don't know what's going to happen to me. I'm not afraid of it. I'm resigned to my fate. I've accepted it. I'm here.
Yeah.
I'm here to work. I'm here to fight for Germany.
You know, remember, Stalin also had at least probably 10 years on Hitler when he became the general secretary of the Communist Party. So he was already killing people 10 years before Hitler came to play.
He had purged the armed forces. I mean,
well, the Great Purge in 1934, he had killed 700,000 people.
And that's just cleaning up Russia a little bit.
I mean, could you imagine taking over a country and then saying, all right, I want these million people to report to this building. a million people, and then they just disappear.
Yeah.
Hey, what happened to Vlad?
Yeah.
Don't bring that up anymore.
You and me saying, hey, Mike, where are you going? Oh, I got this letter I'm supposed to. Yeah, you.
Yeah, I
got to
go meet Stone.
You really don't want to do that, bro. Why? Why? I got the letter I'm supposed to go. Yeah, you might want to get on a horse and get the fuck out of here, man. You're going someplace.
Yeah,
but if I don't go, they'll take my family's land, and you know all this other shit that would happen to your family.
They're still going
to
do it either way.
Yeah, then we all need to go. Right. It just sucks, man. I mean, that's and by whatever, by the way, God decides, you know, who gets born where. That's your lot in life. That's your life. That's how your life's going to end, because some jackass son of a bitch. Yeah, and you're the victim of it. Yeah, and there's
and then you look at
nothing
how
you can
Stalin,
do.
Yeah, when Lenin dies, Stalin kills people to get power. You know, you got the battle between Trotsky and everybody else. So everybody's vying for the power, and Stalin's like, who needs to die? not who do I convince or show great leadership. It's,
right. Who do I got to
kill? These guys need to die.
Yeah.
So out come the knives, the guns. You know, people start disappearing, and then everybody's like, hey, let's put Stalin in charge.
Yeah, before anybody else gets whacked. You know, but That's what, you know, but and that's what's amazing about, I mean, you know, our country in terms of how it was born, you know, the fights that we've had, and the peaceful transfer of power. And that to me is why it was so reprehensible when members of Congress said, I will not attend Donald Trump's inauguration. You know, those days are days that we celebrate the peaceful transfer of power, which is a quintessentially American tradition, and we celebrate our democracy. Whether you're happy or unhappy with the outcome of the election is really a distant second to what we do, how we do it, and celebrating our tradition of living like that, because not everybody did it that way. You know, bloodbaths ensued over power all over the world, and we've never done it like that. And so it's very disappointing when you see that kind of shit go on in this country, that people don't see that stuff. So
yeah, here's a great picture I just sent you. This is funny as hell.
What did you send it?
This is Photoshop.
Text it
in
or?
Russia. No, it's on Skype. This is Photoshop in 1940, and this is pretty good. They're pretty good. So what you see in is the guy on the right, the kid on the right, is Nikolai Yezhov. He is, at that young age, he became the head of the NKVD, which was the police. Right? Yeah. Well, he betrayed Stalin. And this famous photograph, in the famous image, Nikolai Yezhov is shown with Borshlich, Mokolov, and whatever, and Stalin, inspecting the White Sea Canal. And then after he's betrayed, look at the next photo. This image was later altered to remove Yezhov completely.
Wow. How did they
do that? That's pretty good Photoshop in 1940.
That ain't Photoshop. And what do you think they did? How did they cut him out of the picture? How do you do that? You must have had to take in a second picture and then superimpose that over the first one and then kind of
sew it together.
I don't know,
but they did a pretty good job, man.
Holy shit, man. That's in one picture, the guy's standing in the same picture with all the same dudes in it. He's gone. Well, you know, I guess if you were the Soviets, you had to get good at shit like that. Who's like, hey, where's Gunner? He's out.
Yeah, look at it. There's the picture.
He's out in the back drinking vodka. We need him to come in here and tone up another picture. Yeah, he's awesome at that, man. I don't know how he does
look
it. But
there's the before, and we whack Nikolai, and this is what we get.
Yep.
There's the ghostly image where Nikolai used to be.
Yeah. I mean, again, think about that. Won the Ovarian lottery by being born in a country that transfers power peacefully. And then the misfortune of, you know, time and place in life, you know, where you are, you know, when, you know, you're living in a sleepy village and, you know, in the Ukraine, and all of a sudden the Germans come rolling through. Right. Yeah. And you get schwacked because they don't, you know, for whatever reason.
Moscow women digging anti-tank ditches in Moscow, 1941. Because all the men are at war.
Yeah. There's some crazy, crazy stuff. You know, the Russians had, if you can imagine this, they had a parade at the end of the war. And they lined up all this artillery on one side of the city and they fired their artillery. The other thing they did that at night, in the evening. During the day, they marched their divisions back, that were around into Moscow, and they had every German battle colors that they had captured, they brought to Moscow. And then they threw the battle colors against the walls of the Kremlin. And they said it was like people going crazy. Right, that this was their their victory parade. If you can imagine something like that, you're like, holy shit.
Hey, so you've seen the picture of the big three, right?
Yes.
The picture I got up right now?
I'm not seeing it.
You don't see that?
No.
That.
No. I see the NKVD dude who disappeared.
Let me do it again. Bang. Okay. Screen share, done. Now there you see it.
Yes, of course. They going to show me a Photoshop version and Mickey Mouse is going to be sitting where 50R is?
Well, no. Here's the neat thing behind this. So look how low and slumpy Churchill looks.
He was a low, slumpy guy.
Yeah, but they put him in his chair on purpose.
Because he wasn't in the picture? Did they make that picture?
No, they did this picture.
They did it.
And then look how FDR looks stately.
Yes.
You know, regal. Regal. But see, Stalin picks this chair because he believes it's the position of power. Because it's left from right, right?
Is it?
As you look. No. What he misunderstands is the position of power is center.
But
when you have two statesmen, if you're the center man of the two, you're in the position of power.
Yeah, but
Stalin believes the position of power was on the left. So he inadvertently picks the left, screws himself, realizes the mistake, and then in some pictures later on, he gets in the center. But it's too late. He's already done. But it's the funny of the photo, you know, his back is straight, everything else. And then they put Churchill in this slumpy old broken chair. He's got hunched over. You can see his double chin. You know, he just looks spent. But,
did you see that movie? What was the movie that was made recently about Churchill?
Oh, yeah. Churchill.
Is it called Churchill? Yeah, I went to see it. Pretty interesting. Pretty interesting. Pretty interesting movie. And they paint him into, you know, he's about to get run out of the government, and then he's making his speeches and all of that. I thought it was pretty interesting. Pretty interesting.
Yeah. But yeah, you know, when you look at history. History is not what you're taught in school.
You believe it is, though.
You believe everything that you're taught in school.
Yeah.
Even colleges teach only what you want. They want you to see.
Or somebody decides that this is what we should learn, so this is what we're learning. And then you
resist. Yeah, it's a professor that believes this is the way it happened, so I'm going to teach it to my students that this is the way it happened.
Right. And even the professor, his spin, even different than the book. Cherry picks the readings out of the book,
right?
Decides what he's going to emphasize in the course, blah, 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 blah. So, again, it's
history is much more diverse than what you believe.
Yeah.
There's a lot more to it.
Do you remember the first thing that you read or that you went, wait a minute.
It didn't happen this way.
That wasn't my understanding.
Yeah, it was about the Indians.
Really?
Yeah, about how, you know, when growing up as a kid, every time I read about American history, I always read about the unruly Indians always starting in with the army, and the army had to go and fight, you know, put down this rebellion between the Indians and blah, 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 blah. And you're like, huh. And then I was reading books about it, and I'm like, what? Wait a second. You mean to tell me the army rode in when they knew the braves were out? They would ride into these Indian encampments and kill all the women and children?
That can't be true.
What? And then you're like, wait a second, that's how the hatred started? You know, hey, the army comes in under some law and order and says, hey, you guys need to vacate this property.
Indians
are like, what?
Hey, Mike, the doctrine of manifest destiny, which meant
that
we were destined to own North America from sea to shining sea.
But who said that? White people.
We did that.
Yeah, we wrote it in a document.
Yeah, manifest destiny. Could you translate manifest destiny? No, we do not have a term for that.
Our God wants us to own everything on this continent.
Right, and then you can imagine it being translated to the Indian chief. He says, the white man says, their God says that they own all the land from ocean to ocean. We're in South Dakota. What is an ocean?
No, you're in between the ocean and ocean. You got to go.
What is an ocean? An ocean is, and then he explains the ocean. It's like, you tell this crazy white man, you better get out of here or bad stuff's going to happen. What do you mean? You can't just show up and take our shit?
So
they think they can.
Yeah, and that's where it really kind of stunned me, whereas, like, then I started reading a lot about the history of the Native Americans here and how it's just lost.
No, man.
No one cares.
Destroyed.
And so, you know, when I saw this, when this whole, the movement came out about, Black Lives Matter, I really got upset about it. I'm like, what? Okay, again, everything that happened in those days in the 1800s and then all the way up until, hell, 1960s, 1970s, you know, until we started growing up and started looking at things in a different manner, is an atrocity. But you can't tell me it's more of atrocity than what we did to the Native American Indians.
No.
Because
you're right.
Here they were, and we didn't enslave them. We just murdered them. And then we put them in prison camps.
After we marched them across the country.
Because we didn't want them to work. What?
After we marched them across the country, we put them
in moccasins and then skin hide, and then we put them in from southern Texas where they don't even know what snow looks like. And we walk them up into Kansas, and then the first winter they all die. Oh, shit. They weren't prepared, were they? Stupid Indians.
Yeah.
You know, if they were smart Indians, they'd still be alive. They would have been prepared for winter. Hey, jackass, they don't know what winter is.
And there was no structures to house them.
Yeah. And you put them in a field and said, go ahead, build your teepees, you dumb Indians.
Yeah, you know what it is.
I need some trees.
I'm trying to think.
Not our problem.
I'm trying to think the first thing that in when I started looking at history and saying, and it was probably World War II. It was probably that. It was probably, I was in junior college, and I took a class on economic history.
Right.
And the guy who taught it was from Trinidad. And one of the best teachers I've had in my life, his name was Bing Howell. He grew up in London. His father was Trinidad's ambassador to London. So we're doing economic history. And so we're looking at, I want to say the early 20th century and the role that United Fruit Company and Continental Can Company played in American intervention in Latin America. And you're like, well, what do you mean? And so now you begin to read these American corporations that were going down and buying huge swaths of land in Latin America and then asking the State Department, you need to do something to intervene because these people, you know, are coming in and they're burning our plantations. We're being set upon. And the American military intervened. And somebody else's problem, like,
crazy, man.
Yeah, and you're like, well, wait a minute. What happened to, you know, we fight for democracy? You mean we fought for our economic
democracy
rights?
Democracy as long as it's our democracy.
We fought for our economic rights so our corporations could do business in somebody else's country, and they weren't, like, the federal government wasn't supportive of it in terms of the other country's government wasn't supportive of it? Well, kind of, yeah. And then we staged an overthrow and we overthrew the government. You're like, whoa, I'm getting a headache. What do you mean? What's going on here? What about truth, justice, and the American way? Right? What about George Washington, the founding fathers, Mount Rushmore?
Right.
And you're like,
crazy, man.
Yeah. And then so that's how I decided on my major. I took economic history and I thought, you know what? If you don't study economics and you don't understand why nations do things, the rest of it's all bullshit. It's all a fairy tale, right? And then we had a parade and we marched down Elm Street, and you're like, and so that was my experience where somebody pulled the curtain back on me. Yeah, and I remember, and so then when I chose my major in college, I thought, well, if I want to understand history, I need to study economic history. If I want to understand economic history, I should study economics. But economics sucked because it was so much math. Oh my God, it was awful.
Yeah, so. And you know, when you look at the whole Indian thing, how the Indians ended up, it's kind of, I don't know if the word. What would be the word, but we fought for our independence against the crown, the British, right?
British, right.
And that lasted 10, 11 years until we really, really fully became an independent, not sovereign at the point, but close. We were recognized in the world now. But we did the same damn thing to the Indians. The Indians were us, and we were the British. They fought against the tyranny of us, and we wanted what they had, which was land. It's crazy that we can justify the American Revolution because it freed us from the tyrannical rule of the British Empire.
What is that concept, Mike?
But the Indians,
isn't it the concept, like, it's called American exceptionalism? So our perspective is like, hey, we're right. Our purpose is right. Our Constitution is right. Therefore,
the crazy thing.
What we do is right.
And see, that's where, if you really want to be a true truist and find the truth, you need to understand that our American, that definition is kind of flawed. And I agree with that. I do. Because why? I'm an American. I would rather have the whole world be Americans. That would be my goal. And as your Supreme Leader, if you vote for me in the next Supreme Leader elections, I will do such a thing. I will convert everybody to be in my view of the perspective of the world, and those that don't conform with me, we'll go to the
app. Let me just read the definition. American exceptionalism. American exceptionalism is an ideology holding the United States as unique among nations in positive or negative connotations with respect to its ideas of democracy and personal freedom. Though the concept has no formal definition, there are some themes common to various conceptions of the idea. Some of the themes are nationalism. So it's an interesting topic, but it is that unique American, and our perspective relative to Native Americans was, this belongs to us.
Right.
Like, bro, we've been here for 1,000 years, maybe longer. What do you mean it belongs to you? Yeah, right. we fought for it. We fought the British for it. Who? We don't even know who they are. Like, who are they?
Yeah.
They were like 1,500 miles away from you. Okay. Come on. No, it is crazy. It is crazy. But nonetheless, we're a great country. But again, what we're talking about is an unvarnished look, if you're going to take a look at it. And you got to read the footnote.
I can live with that.
And you got to understand that it's as great as the United States is, it's a flawed endeavor, as are most countries.
Yeah, to be great, you gotta step through kind of the ugly parts of the path. It's not all freaking rose beds and fairies and butterflies. No, there's some nasty stuff you gotta step in. And if you're okay with that, which I am, but that's my point though, is you need to understand how we got there. People suffer. Good people suffer for us to get to where we are.
Horribly.
Yeah.
Horribly. With their only life.
Yeah, you only get one, right?
This is my only life, and I just had some dude roll in and line my family up, and now we're all going to die. My only life. And what did we do?
That's why I guess you do. You make the best of yours then, because of that, the path we got to get here. Make the best of it.
It's all you can do.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Great.
All right. Any other exciting things going on this weekend?
No. Did a yard work today.
Ooh. What are you doing?
No, we already done. Six.
It's already done.
Complete bags full. Tree trimmed, bushes trimmed, side bushes trimmed.
Once you start, do you have to pressure wash now after that? Normally,
no, we're good. No.
Pressure wash is good. And Henrietta's home? Why is Henrietta home?
Because it's Friday.
She doesn't work on Friday?
No.
Ooh, so that's a built-in 3-day weekend?
Wow. Yeah.
That's a good gig, man. That is a solid gig when you have a three-day weekend. I think the work week should be 4 10-hour days.
Yes.
And a three-day weekend, because 3 days is nice. 2 days, not long enough. 3 days, nice.
Yeah.
So
anyway. We're going to go to lunch, Henrietta.
Oh, where are you going to lunch? Christina's?
Henrietta is a hippo.
What?
Henrietta is a hippo.
It's a book.
You're calling me a hippo?
It's a book.
Did you know Henrietta was a hippo?
I did.
Then why didn't you say something?
Well, I know.
You know her?
I know.
Now she's pissed off at me. She's looking at me going, you know Henrietta was a hippo?
Only kids, no, only people who read children's books know that. It is kind of an old, stodgy name.
I forgot that part. I don't even know. I don't even know the story.
Henrietta
is a hippo. Yeah. She's right.
Thanks for taking care of me. You should have done that.
It's not. It's not.
I wouldn't use that word because that's a hippo.
Henrietta Hippo.
Did you say that?
It was a 1970s cartoon and she was a character on the New Zoo Review.
I remember now. I'm looking at it. The New Zoo Review.
I think it was the New Zoo Review coming at you, is how it
started. Yeah, 1970s kids. That's actually funny, man.
I didn't watch that shit. My youngest sister.
I didn't
sister
watch it either,
did.
But now
my youngest sister
I remember
did. She used to watch that and some other shit I didn't like. What was it? God, it was a cartoon show that I hated. I threw a fit. Get this off the TV. We're not watching it. Please, Michael, please. And I would always.
I didn't watch this. This one freaked me out. They're singing most of the time through the show.
Yeah.
So I would never listen to this. There's an owl, frog.
So you're going to have to rename Henrietta?
Yeah.
What are you going to give her? Carmen. That's an exotic name.
Carmen. No.
Carmen. I like Carmen.
Carmen. How about just Sapphire?
How about... That's a stripper name, okay?
I know. Because that's the first thing she'll say. Now you call me a stripper.
Well, do you want to be a hippopotamus? I'll give you a choice.
Sapphire.
You could be a hippopotamus or a stripper. What do you want? Stripper. Come
You're
on.
Not a hippo.
See, there you go. I want to be a stripper. Okay, so you and Sapphire are going to lunch. Where are you going to lunch? Petroleum Club?
I don't know. I'll let you know.
All right. I mean, you need a few minutes of your time this weekend.
All right.
All right.
Hey, you talked to the girl?
Yeah, you know, I did.
Okay.
I did. Okay, a couple of times.
Okay, cool.
And I sent her the link. I don't know I told you, but if you have not watched the movie.
Yes, the Elizabeth Smart movie.
You need to watch it. The link is on the All Marine Radio website. If you go to, I think it's the README page, or no, the Read Board page on the website. Okay. So you go to the website, you click on README. You'll see Elizabeth Smart, and if you click on the link, it'll take you to part one. It's a two-part thing. You'll see part two pop up after part one plays, but by all means, absolutely, positively watch that. So I sent her, after she and I chatted about what you and I had talked about, then I sent her the link. I said, you should watch this. She said, okay, I will. Thank you. So anyway, so that'll happen eventually.
Yeah, she's... talking in Iowa. She's in Iowa. She's in the U.S. right now, so we got to contact her.
I tried, but they don't answer. She's a pretty big...
I'm going to try and find her.
She's she has a foundation, right? She lives in Scotland. She's got a foundation. So I've emailed the foundation a couple different times. So if you have another way to get at her... and again, I said, you know, and Elizabeth Smart's message is a message of hope. You know, sometimes bad things happen in life, and that doesn't mean, you can't live a good life. You can.
Elizabeth Smart's message is, you know,
strength, surviving, moving on, you know, the whole thing.
Right, and all the things we talk about. She's an incredible example. Between the ages of 14, raped almost on a nightly basis for close to 10 months. Right, there's a girl who's got every ticket punched to be dysfunctional and whatever, but she's not. She now has two kids, she's married, and she's doing good things in her, with her life. And so that's our whole thing of post-traumatic winning, post-traumatic growth. You know, this is not a disability just because you went through difficult times. It for many yeah, people, it is the springboard to do great things, and that's what we advocate for. So
okay, and she's at Iowa State University on October 5th.
Well, then get up there. You're close to
yeah.
it. Hey, I'm.
All right.
I'm gone.
I'll track her down.
All right. All right. Have a good one.
All right. I'll talk to you later, man.
There you have it. That is Michael Christopher Musselman.
Leadership staff. Out there.
The and that'll do it for a Friday edition of All Marine Radio here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network. The let me read you another email. Mac, I was watching some highlights last night. Your Yankees got into a little bit of a dust-up. My question for you, CC Sabathia was 2 innings short of qualifying for a $500,000 bonus. He would have got there, no doubt in my mind. But he chose to retaliate because he thought one of the Yankees had been thrown at in an unprofessional manner. The pitch was up around his catcher's head, Kevin Roman. Would you have done the same? You know, $500,000 is a lot of money. Let me say that right now. But when you're on a team, you live by the code of the samurai, man. If you can't walk in there and raise your head, Facebook reveals 50 million accounts were affected by a security breach. Nice. Well done. That's according to Yahoo News. Yeah, I've always been on teams, and I've lived in that world. So to me, if you can't stand up on your hind legs in that environment, then you don't belong there. So is that doing the right thing? Then you got to do the right thing. Ouch, though, huh? We'll see if the Yankees actually ultimately pay that. Potentially awesome movie coming out on limited release. Title is Black 4-7. Set in Ireland during the Great Famine, the drama follows an Irish ranger who had been fighting for the British Army abroad as he abandons his post to reunite with his family. The Irish are always up to no good. Would have been here's another piece of breaking news. This is 14 minutes old. F-35B jet crashes in South Carolina. The pilot is believed to have ejected, but his status is unknown, officials say. The F-35 Bravo Joint Strike Fighter conducted its first ever strike yesterday in combat in Afghanistan. So the headline reads, F-35B jet crashes in South Carolina. Senate Judiciary Committee is set to vote in 9 minutes on Brett Kavanaugh. My prediction, that'll lead the committee along party lines. Whenever this happens, if you want to see the most current news, right, go to Twitter, right, and in the search box, type in hashtag F35. Then what you do is then you get all the Twitter stuff, all right? So if you then you once you, you get the top, if you click on top, you'll get the however Twitter rates them, right? However Twitter rates stories, you get maybe they're the most prominent. You get the most prominent stories. If you click on the latest tab, you'll see everything, right? And then what happens is you'll see here's somebody, some guy, who there's a picture of a smoke. It looks like by some kind of inlet, waterway. Military plane crash in Beaufort near Joe Allen Drive area appears to have crashed on a bluff island owned by Clarendon Plantations. Not usually many people over there, praying for the safety of all involved. And so Twitter, when this stuff happens, if you go to Twitter, you'll see the most breaking news as it happens. And there's a number of things going on. Evidently, what the British aircraft carrier that's over here, wondering if this aircraft was part of the exercise where American F-35 Bravos were going to land and take off from British carrier. Right, and the story is military officials have confirmed that a Marine F-35 Bravo fighter aircraft has crashed in Beaufort County, South Carolina, adjacent to Marine Corps Air Station Beaufort. The pilot is believed to have ejected. No update on the pilot status at this time. So again, if you go to Twitter and you type in F-35, there's another feed that's trending for F-35 Bravo. Not sure that it would have anything in addition. Just scrolling through it, stand by. And this is 2 hours ago. History is made, the first F-35 Bravo taking off from the HMS Queen Elizabeth. A great sight to see. After all this time, we are getting there. Well done to everyone on board and everyone at the Royal Navy on a job well done, and thank you for defending our great country. And then there's another link that has an image of the F-35 Bravo Marine type taking off of the HMS Queen Elizabeth II. So not sure whether the aircraft involved was involved in this, but again, keep our fingers crossed that the pilot ejected safely, and all we're dealing with is the loss of an aircraft. So, that's how you keep track of breaking news when it breaks this fast. So, Have a great day. Have a great weekend. If you missed the start of the program, don't touch that dial. You'll get to hear it now. As, you know, in the first hour, we talked about how did we get to the point where sequestration and what we saw yesterday, those are now normal events? That's the way we do things now? And what's abnormal is what John McCain stood on the floor of the Senate and called regular order? That's abnormal now? So, yeah, painful to watch. What changed in our country? So we'll talk about that. And then the chef joined us, and a buddy of his was with him, and he was a baker. So we'll talk about being a baker. We'll do that. All of that coming up next. So, again, thoughts and prayers right now with the pilot of an aircraft who's ejected in South Carolina, adjacent to Marine Corps Air Station Buford. Again, the only information we have is that he is said to have ejected. His status is unknown. So, have a great day. We'll see you on Monday. Alex Hollings will join us then. We're going to do another battle study next week, a follow-up to the Battle of Gitlin's Corner I did with General Butch Neal, retired, one of the squad leaders. So the story is this, pretty interesting. India 3-9 is told by their operations officer, conduct three platoon-sized ambushes. So there's essentially three platoon-sized ambushes set in or being set in, and the company headquarters element gets attacked on Hill 70. One of the squad leaders that was on Hill 70, where Lieutenant John Bobo, his actions earned him a posthumous Medal of Honor, and there's four Navy crosses awarded there as well. He's going to join us. Yep, Jack Riley. So we'll talk to him and get his perspective on it. So, with that said, keep your, say a prayer, and we will see you on Monday. So, on a Friday, All Marine Radio, over and out.